Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Thursday, March 25th. Before we begin our work, let's have a roll call.
Representative Levy.
Present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is here by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Present by video. Thank you. We have four items on our agenda today. Before we begin, I would like everyone who is not a committee member to please turn off your camera and your microphone. And as we call people to testify on the bills, please remember to turn your camera on. If you have one, we'd love to see you as you testify. Thank you. Someone has a microphone on. Maybe it's off now. Let's check quickly. Let's make sure everyone has their mic off unless they're speaking. All right. We have several items today on our agenda, four public hearings. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3317. This was carried over. We had a couple of witnesses who weren't able to testify when we adjourned our meeting, so we carried this over. We're continuing the public hearing. LRO, do you have anything to explain to us before we continue with the witness list?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern for Legislative Revenue. No, I'll just remind the committee that this is a property tax exemption for hay balers.
Okay.
That's all.
Thank you. The first witness is actually in replacing someone who had signed up previously, but who can't join us today. And speaking on her behalf will be Mary Ann Cooper. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. Yes, my name is Mary Ann Cooper, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau, a very poor substitute for Samantha Bayer, who is our lobbyist who works on this issue. But wanted to convey the Farm Bureau, we've been involved with the farm equipment tax exemption really since its inception, and we've subsequently been involved in a number of work groups that have really spanned multiple decades on this issue. So as I'm sure you heard last week or hearing earlier this week, the current law exempts certain pieces of farm machinery and equipment from the ad valorem property taxation that are tangible personal property and used primarily for a number of reasons around farm crops. We believe that the Department of Revenue's administrative rules and the subsequent case law stemming from those rules have substantially narrowed this the interpretation of this statute and made it much less workable for our farmers. And that really came to a head in 2018 when some Marion County farms contacted us about some discrepancies in the implementation of the exemption by the county. Some farmers had received letters from assessors stating that certain pieces of machinery and equipment should be taxed, while others did not receive letters and did not pay the tax. Most of our folks, as we started talking to them, believed that all of their tangible personal property was to be exempted, and they were unaware of the nuance in the administrative rules and the subsequent case law. So Oregon Farm Bureau, we believe that the current administrative interpretation of the statute is overly narrow and does not address the realities of farming and harvest activities. Under the leadership of yourself, Chair Nathanson, and Representative Marsh, Oregon Farm Bureau and another number of stakeholders have been participating in a work group since last session. The goal of this work group is to review the current law, identify where clarity is needed, and address problems that have arisen in Marion County and elsewhere with regard to what equipment is taxable on the farm. For us, unfortunately, House Bill 3317 does not address the broader issues that were identified in the work group and takes an approach that we cannot support at this time. To be clear, we do not take issue with Hay Presses being exempted from property tax. We support that, but there simply remain significant issues with interpretation, enforcement, taxpayer education, and other issues and other equipment that must be addressed in order for the exemption to be properly utilized. And adding a piece of equipment or adding any equipment piece by piece is not going to solve the bigger issues at hand. We are very thankful for the opportunity to participate in the work group, and we hope that the committee will allow it to continue in the interim in order to address these important issues in a comprehensive manner. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Levy.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Hi, Mary Ann. I just need to clarify that we're all looking at the same ORS number, ORS 307.394, which covers farm equipment, and that essentially in most counties, it's farm equipment that's pulled behind a tractor as well as a tractor. Is that correct? It doesn't say that per se, but what it does say is farm machinery and equipment used primarily in the preparation of land, planting, raising, cultivating, or harvesting farm crops, or feeding, breeding, management, or sale of, or the produce of livestock, poultry, fur-bearing animals, bees, dairies, agriculture, or horticultural use, which would seem to me that covers all the equipment that's listed in here, except for the hay press that's bolted to the ground in a building that compresses the hay to ship it overseas. Is that correct? Is that the way? Maybe Chris might interpret that differently, but that's the way our county interprets it.
Yes, and so I think Representative Levy, so Chair Nathanson and Representative Levy, I think what you're hitting is some of the issue around the interpretation. So in our view, and particularly when you're looking at the placing and storage of farm crops that is part of 307.394, we think that is where the rules in the case law have really narrowed what's considered tangible personal property and what they consider for harvest or for placing in storage. And for example, they've said that any equipment used to in the field to wash, box, or sort crops is actually considered processing and not exempted under ORS 307.394. That is where the issues have come in. And I will tell you, Samantha is really our expert on this, and I have read a 15-page memorandum that she has done going through all of the case law. And I think what I will say for purposes of this hearing and this committee is that it's a really nuanced analysis and discussion, and I think that is where we are wanting that work group to come in and be able to look at the totality of what folks are doing both on farm and, for example, with hay presses or with other things that go into placing those farm products in storage, and figure out what both what the intent is but also what the legislature wants, how the legislature wants to treat those, because I don't think there is a consistent application across the counties. Again, as I understand it, I am not our staff person that primarily works on this issue.
Thank you very much. I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing, and I believe we are. And then I believe that the work group that Rep. Marsh is working on is, for me, I still believe her work group is the best method for this bill. So thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Levy, and thank you, Ms. Cooper, for your responses. The next witness is Jesse Bounds.
Can you guys?
Hello.
Hello, are you there?
We're listening.
Chair Nathanson and committee, thank you for having me. Good afternoon. My name is Jesse Bounds. I'm the owner of Bounds Hay Company in Junction City, Oregon. I'm here in support of HB 3317. The Oregon grass straw market is a very specialized market created from the ban on field and stack burning in the Willamette Valley. The majority of the straw harvested in Oregon is shipped overseas. This is why we use the hay compressing equipment to maximize the amount of straw we can fit into a 40-foot ocean container. Oregon has competitors in other countries, Chinese rice straw, Australian oat hay, along with other products from Spain and countries like Canada. In South Korea, there's also a quota that limits the number of tons of U.S. straw and Timothy hay that is allowed to be imported. Other countries like Australia, China, Canada do not have these quota restrictions. Straw compressing companies have been faced with years of challenges from the port slowdown at Terminal 6, which led to our only shipping carrier leaving Oregon, which then led most companies, forced them into purchasing more trucks to haul into Tacoma and Seattle ports. At that time, we also had to purchase new trucks to meet clear air standards at the Seattle-Tacoma ports. We're now faced with the worst global shipping crisis we have ever seen due to COVID. In addition, most straw companies also are possibly faced with overtime mandates in future as well as farming. Straw compressing doesn't change the product like other processing or packaging equipment. If it's straw coming in, it's straw coming out. Similar to a baler in the field, the straw press is typically at one location and is used for maximizing shipping container weights. This lowers the trucking and ocean freight cost, the amount of trips that would be used on the road and on ocean vessels. We can load almost twice as much into a container pressed than non-pressed. This is the same process as baling hay or straw in the field. This is simply used for the ease of transportation, stacking, and storing for animal consumption. Most of the court cases used by the counties are food processing where the products may be changed or used for human consumption. This is not the case with compressing straw. At my location, we also have a chaff press. We use this to rebale loose material that falls on the floor when we are compressing the primary bale. We use the chaff press to then repackage for hauling to local dairies or feedlots. With this press, this straw is mostly a waste product. The number of trips we would haul on the road could be 4 to 5 times as more without it being compressed. We can't burn the waste, or do we want to burn? We would rather transport to an end user. In Oregon, we don't have very many feedlots or dairies to resell these products to. The compressing equipment helps us transport this product much more efficient further distances. Some hay presses also own small presses that recycle baling twine. This would be taxed possibly as well. If the companies don't repress this twine, it's not recycled. Currently, some counties tax hay or straw compressing equipment and some don't. I've even found that some assessors call it personal property and some call it real. This bill would solve the confusion for straw compressing owners and the county assessors in regards to the hay compressed equipment. I have never filed a personal property return. All of my equipment is farm equipment, which is exempt. I received a letter from Lane County requesting me to file a return. We looked on the statute and determined we are exempt from what we could read online. Lane County responded and stated, I do need to file and I'm not exempt. Since then, we've been going rounds and rounds about what is and what isn't. As we have heard or will hear, this bill doesn't fix all those issues, but it would clear up the hay compressing equipment itself. I do support the Farm Bureau as well. Would like to see a work group continue, but I do support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Committee members, are there any questions remaining for either witness before we close the public hearing on 3317? I'm not seeing any hands up. Thank you, Ms. Cooper, Mr. Bounds, for your testimony this afternoon. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3317. I intend to take the remaining bills in the order in which they are printed. I'm not aware of any legislators who are signed up to testify. Is that still correct, Manny?
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you. Then I will take these in the order in which they are printed on the agenda. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2096, LRO.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, House Bill 2096 is a bill that's making changes to an existing tax credit that we have, in this case, the Agricultural Workforce Housing Tax Credit, which is a credit aimed at supporting the construction, rehabilitation, or acquisition of agricultural workforce housing. So what House Bill 2096 is doing is it's increasing the maximum amount of agricultural workforce housing tax credits that may be issued, and it's increasing that from the current level, which is limited to 3.625 million tax credits per year, to no more than 24 million in total potential credits that could be claimed in a biennium. So that's the change. There is some renaming of terms, which is a lot of the changes in terms of the pages of the bill. But the overall, or the bill itself, would take effect January 1st, 2022.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions or clarifications you'd like from LRO before we start our witness list? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Easton, you said, what's the amount currently, the maximum amount now? I got the $24 million, but just clarifying what the current maximum amount allowed or tax credits is allowed.
Yes, Representative Reschke, as of right now, it's $3,625,000 per year.
Okay, and that's per year. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
We have two witnesses signed up to speak. First, I'm inviting Margaret Salazar, and after that will be Peter Hanley.
Thank you so much, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I'm here to talk with you today about House Bill 2096 and the Agricultural Worker Housing Tax Credit. This is a proven state income tax credit given to those who incur costs to construct, install, acquire, or rehabilitate housing for the agricultural workforce. This program has supported developments across the state, from Madras to Ashland to Sandy to Forest Grove and many places in between. It goes without question that agricultural workers are among the most essential workers here in our state. When COVID hit, farm workers could not work from home. And Oregon's agricultural workers are on the front lines during this pandemic, working to provide food for all of our families. Agricultural work sites and food processing plants have unfortunately been the source of some COVID-19 outbreaks in Oregon. The pandemic appears to be disproportionately affecting agricultural workers, and the recent Oregon COVID-19 farm worker study demonstrated that more than a third of farm workers surveyed reported infected coworkers, and 20% reported cases in their household. And then, of course, we all saw the wildfires tearing through our state in the fall, and we knew that working conditions were worsening with hazardous and smoky air. As we look ahead toward an equitable recovery and the long-term recovery from these crises, the needs of our essential workforce must be front and center. House Bill 2096 offers a solution by increasing the Agricultural Worker Housing Tax Credit to expand this proven model. Around 80% of agricultural worker housing tax credits are used for in-community developments, and that's nonprofits that pair these resources with standard affordable housing development resources that come with affordability covenants, meaning that the rent must be affordable to low-income people for a defined period of time. This tax credit can pay for 50% of the eligible costs to complete a farm worker housing project. These credits are often transferred to a contributor or investor of the project, particularly for nonprofit developers. Owners of these developments are then required to provide housing to agricultural workers and their families for at least 10 years. OHCS administers the Agricultural Worker Housing Tax Credit yearly on a first-come, first-served basis. House Bill 2096 would provide OHCS with the flexibility to administer the program yearly or biennially. This allows OHCS to pair the tax credits with our other fund offerings for affordable housing construction, meaning that housing developers could apply for this tax credit at the same time that they apply for other state dollars, which would be a more efficient process for all involved. The bill also has a minor technical edit confirming the use of agricultural worker in statute instead of farm worker, which is a more expansive definition. However, the most important aspect of this bill is the $9.5 million increase for a total of $24 million per biennium, which will enable the development of approximately 240 new homes. We know that this is a chronically oversubscribed resource. That means we just don't have enough to go around and meet the applications, and so it's ripe for new investment. I urge your vote in support of this bill.
Thank you. We have a couple of questions for you. Representative Levy.
Ms. Salazar, I'm not real. Oh, thank you, Chair Nathanson. Ms. Salazar, I'm not sure if you can answer this question, but we have H-2A workers, and we part of the H2A program is that you provide housing for them. But we'd like to do better housing than what we have, and it's fairly expensive. Does this also apply to H2A workers? Because I've had other farmers that do that as well, and they also want to do that, but it's cost prohibitive right now.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Levy, thank you for the question. This program can be used to serve H2A workers, but the preference has typically been for long-term residents, as we see the share of agricultural workers that are long-term residents growing in our communities. We know we have a housing shortage, but it can be used as well for H2A workers and for on-farm developments.
Thank you very much.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did have a question, Ms. Salazar. You talked about a 10-year, I just wanted to know if you could explain what happens after 10 years where they're required to remain affordable. Do often these housing units convert to market rate, or what happens with them? Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Representative, thank you so much for the question. I will get back to you with the details of the compliance and what happens at the end of the 10-year period. Typically for our multifamily housing developments, after 10 to 15 years, they need to be recapitalized. So the end of a compliance period is an opportunity to come in with new resources to be able to make needed repairs and to shore up those properties for the long term. This tax credit can also be used to make those repairs, but I will get back to you on the details of what happens at the end of that compliance period. I'll note one other thing, which is that being able to put out these dollars in alignment with our other affordable housing dollars, many of those affordable housing programs have longer term use restrictions. So by tying this tax credit in with those other dollars, we're also locking in a greater length of protection for the long-term affordability and viability of the properties. But we can follow up with more detail.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the responses. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Salazar. My question is, does the building of these housing units, does it have to be, quote, on the farm, or can it be somewhere else as long as it just houses farm workers?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Representative. We allow for both on-farm and in-community developments. And so there are a couple of different models that folks have used very successfully. And as we see, again, the growing workforce and residential year-round workforce in our state, those in-community developments have been very, very helpful to build out the affordable housing stock in our communities.
Thank you for your answer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions for Ms. Salazar? We're ready to go. Thank you for your testimony. The next witness will be Peter Hanley.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Reschke and Pham. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of CASA of Oregon. CASA, for the last 33 years, has been working to provide farm worker housing around the state. We work with housing authorities, nonprofits, and community development corporations to build housing. We have completed approximately 40 housing projects in 22 distinct cities or counties, providing nearly 5,200 spaces to families, to farm workers and their families. We've also assisted farmers in the renovation of about 1,300 bed spaces of on-farm housing. All told, probably close to 6,000 farm workers and their families have been housed using this tax credit. And those are just the projects that CASA has worked on. So I would estimate that there's probably close to 10,000 bed spaces that provide farm workers a place to lay their head down at night. There were a couple questions about the affordability beyond the 10 years from Representative Pham. And as Director Salazar mentioned, most of these tax credits are matched with other state or federal programs that have very long periods of affordability. So of all the projects that we have developed, I only know of one where the project went from a farm worker project to a general population That was in Ontario. And as I understand it, there's still a large number of farm workers that are living in that project. Representative Reschke had mentioned, you know, if it can be used on and off farm. We actually did a project down in Klamath Falls about 18 years ago on Homedale Road for the Klamath Housing Authority. I just want to say this is a very effective way of providing housing. I think given the large number of farm workers that were displaced in the wildfires down in southern Oregon, we're going to be needing all the resources we can get to rebuild some of that housing. So I urge you to pass HB 2096 as amended. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the testimony. Committee, any questions for either of these witnesses? Did we receive any other names of persons wishing to testify before the deadline?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Probably a question for Mr. Easton, and he may or may not have the answer, but I'd like to know it at some time before we work this bill. It would be, when was the last time that the ceiling was changed? So has this been a tax credit? I'm just kind of trying to understand the history of this tax credit and when it started, and has it been ratcheting up, or is this the first time that it's gone from the 3 point whatever million annually to 24 million per biennium?
Yes, Representative Reschke, this was one of the tax credits that was reviewed in the 2019 session. So we do have a tracking of all the statutory changes, and I can make that. I can go ahead and send that to the committee members where we highlight the changes in the amounts and also the amount of the credit and such that would give you that history.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mr. Easton, is there anything you would like to add or clarify before I close the public hearing on this bill?
Not at this time, Madam Chair. We are in communication with the Department of Housing on some of the discussions ongoing with how this credit would change and underlying demand and such. So okay. More to come later, yes.
Thank you. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2096, and thank you both for your testimony. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2446, LRO.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. This is Jamie McGovern for Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2446 is a property tax exemption. And essentially, charitable institutions and their property tend to be property tax exempt. But in, I think, 2014, HB 4039 clarified that if a nonprofit owned low-income housing, that would still qualify for the property tax exemption. There had been some question on clarification prior to that as to whether individuals living in the property would make that violate or the exclusive use clause for charitable institutions. So low-income housing owned by charitable institutions or nonprofits is currently property tax exempt. That's set to sunset in July 1st, 2022. This would extend that property tax exemption to July 1st, 2028.
Thank you.
Oh, and one more thing. Apologies. This does not, this is just for the nonprofit housing portion of nonprofits. It doesn't affect any of the other charitable institution portions.
Thanks for that additional clarification. We have three people signed up to testify. Manny, did we have any additional names after the list was printed?
No, there hasn't been any additions.
Okay, thank you. I would like to thank the previous speakers for holding their comments to around 3 minutes. We give a little leeway usually, but I'd like to express appreciation for that already. We should be able to hear everyone remaining testifying on this bill and the next bill. The speakers for House Bill 2446 are Kristen Carl, Allison McIntosh, and Josh Graves. So first, Kristen Carl.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Carley, and I'm here on behalf of St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County. St. Vincent de Paul is a nonprofit community development corporation. We provide shelter and emergency services for the homeless, low barrier employment opportunities through our waste-based businesses, and over 1,600 units of affordable housing located primarily in Lane and Marion counties. I'd like to express my support for House Bill 2446. Not extending this would directly impact approximately 131 units in our portfolio located in both urban and rural Lane County. Residents who live in these properties vary from some of our most vulnerable, such as duly diagnosed chronically homeless veterans and seniors on fixed incomes, to folks working low-wage jobs like grocery and retail clerks, restaurant workers, home health care workers, and child care providers, among others, whom we now rightfully identify as essential workers. Property tax exemptions are one of the tools that help enable us to offer rents well below 50% of area median income. Not extending the sunset really does impact the properties, St. Vincent de Paul, and our residents. I'd ask you to please consider these properties were initially financially structured to assume they would not pay property taxes because they were considered part of our charitable purpose under 307.130 at the time they were built or acquired. Eliminating the exemption will increase operating expenses for the projects that are already very difficult to operate because most are over 30 years old and have very low rents. Increasing expenses means less money for other items such as regular maintenance, capital needs, and resident services. If our expenses increase because of a loss of a property tax exemption, as St. Vincent de Paul must consider raising rents to cover for this new cost. Thank you for your time and consideration. And again, I urge you to support this.
Thank you for the testimony. Next is Allison McIntosh.
Nathanson, Vice Chair Ruski, Vice Chair Pham, members of the committee, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance to express support for House Bill 2446. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of more than 90 organizations from all parts of the state, and we believe that all Oregonians need a safe, stable, and affordable place to call home. As you heard, we have many local, state, and federal tools to help pay for the development of apartment homes that are greatly needed across Oregon. And rental homes that receive public funds in exchange follow strict rules about the incomes of people who qualify for the housing and how much rent can be charged. Unfortunately, the need for these homes is far greater than the currently available resources. Property tax exemptions are one tool to help incentivize and make financially viable affordable housing developments across our state, and over the years, the legislature has authorized several property tax exemptions for affordable housing. Property tax exemptions for affordable housing are critical for several reasons. They recognize the importance of affordable housing in our communities and provide an ongoing financial subsidy to the project by lowering the annual operating expense. Without property tax exemptions, affordable housing developers would need additional resources to serve the lowest income members of our community, and typically those additional resources would come from public entities. Because rents are restricted to people with low incomes, and because the regulation of funding sources generally don't allow it, the development cannot simply raise rents to cover a significant cost increase. Property tax exemptions support the development and continued existence of affordable housing in communities. The exemption being extended through House Bill 2446 has a unique history. Prior to 2013, many affordable housing developments qualified for a property tax exemption under 307.130, which allows nonprofit organizations to receive a property tax exemption. Whether or not an affordable housing development received this exemption used to be a matter of local policy, meaning a local county assembly assessor would have decided whether the property qualified under that statute. However, due to a change in policy by the Department of Revenue, local assessors began canceling property tax exemptions previously granted to these projects. But these projects were financed and constructed with the assumption that they would remain exempt from property taxes. And as rents are restricted, they cannot simply be raised to meet additional expenses. So these organizations faced significant unplanned for expenses. As a result of this change in policy, a lawsuit was filed to challenge the change in policy by the Department of Revenue, and there was a tax court filing that I have referenced in my submitted written testimony. The tax court found that affordable housing developments did not meet the criteria for the exemption under 307-130B because they received rent. So as a result of that change in policy and court decision, affordable housing properties across Oregon were suddenly no longer eligible for this exemption and were faced with either closing or seeking additional subsidy. So as you heard, and I will wrap it up, in 2014, the legislature passed House Bill 4039, which created an exemption explicitly for these properties. And I would just note for you as I close that this property tax exemption that is being extended does not allow for any new affordable housing developments to qualify. It simply maintains the existing affordable housing. We urge your support of House Bill 2446. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony and for also submitting materials to the committee to read. It's a good reminder, and I didn't do it at the beginning of the hearing or the meeting today. Anyone who has additional thoughts, comments, explanations, responses to questions, anything you might want to add to your testimony, you have up to 24 hours after the meeting started to submit written testimony for this committee. And we would welcome that if you have anything additional for us. The next speaker is Josh Graves.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, committee members. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. For the record, I am Josh Graves, the CEO of Catholic Community Services and Catholic Community Services Foundation, a 501c3 that was established in 1938 and has been serving our community ever since. About 15 years ago, I like to say we backed our way into the affordable housing market or housing service because other providers started giving us their affordable housing portfolios. They were not able to raise the funds and manage the costs of keeping these housing complexes, particularly the older ones that we're talking about today, up. And I urge you to support House Bill 2446. We currently operate about 200 units of affordable housing, a little over 200 units, and a little over 500 people living in those units. As you've already heard, many of the people that we serve in this affordable housing are seniors, people with disabilities, and low-income families. We currently have 21 complexes, and 16 of those 21 complexes are directly impacted by House Bill 2446. I can just assure you that there is no margin in the affordable housing market. Many of these properties came to us severely distressed, and we have been raising money, working with donors and foundations to improve these properties, and we have made significant improvements in these properties. We want these properties to be nurturing environments for the people who live in them, to enjoy them, to feel hope, and not to be marginalized because they live in affordable housing. And this is so incredibly important for us to be able to maintain that mission. As was said in previous testimony, we don't want to raise rents, and we want to improve the properties, we want to beautify the properties, and we really want to support the people that live there. This is incredibly important to our communities in this housing crisis and this time in our community. So thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Committee, any questions for these three witnesses? I'm not seeing any. Thank you again for your testimony. Ms. McGovern, this bill comes to us from another committee, and I think it came to us with a unanimous vote. I am not aware of any other amendments or issues or concerns that were raised in the prior committee. Can you tell us anything more about the history of this bill before it got to our committee?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, you're absolutely correct. This came from the House Committee on Housing. There was a public hearing on January 28th. The notable issue or question that was raised, I gave a short presentation on the history of this, was what the definition of low-income housing meant, and essentially the 60% of median income, and then allowing people to sort of improve their status to the 80%, but still remain in housing. According to low-income definitions, which are pretty standard throughout statute. And then this was voted out of the House Committee on Housing unanimously on March 4th with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add for us in response to public testimony or any additional information before I close this public hearing? Anybody? Okay, we've completed the witness list for House Bill 2446. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2446. Our final public hearing of the day, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2584, LRO.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Once again, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, House Bill 2584 is a bill that's also making a change to an existing tax credit we have here. This bill did come to you first, or is coming to you from the House Housing Committee. It did, I'm looking at the history here, it did come out do pass recommendation on an 8-0 vote. And the committee did adopt one amendment, the Dash 2 amendment, which I'll get to in the description here in just a moment of what came out of the Housing Committee as well. But so 2584, and we do have a Dash A3 amendment, which I'll also get to in just a moment, relates to an existing tax credit, the Affordable Housing Lenders Tax Credit. So just trying to briefly set this up, the Affordable Housing Lenders Tax Credit is a tax credit, as the name suggests, aimed at supporting the development, construction, rehabilitation of affordable housing. And it does that through targeting the lenders for this construction, rehabilitation of the housing. And it does this by offering a credit that would encourages or more or less covers the cost to the lender to reduce that interest rate on the loan. So it can reduce that interest rate up to 4 percentage points on the loan. The credit kind of covers that cost reduction of what would normally be the cost to the loan, the interest rate at the market value. So the lender gets a credit to that. The value of that credit then, in many cases, gets passed through to the housing and the tenants of the affordable housing. So it passes through that tax credit benefit. The first change in House Bill 2584 has to do with the overall limit, similar to the last bill or the bill you heard earlier. It's increasing the limit for the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit in any fiscal year. The total outstanding amount of the credits, that's the limit in this case, it increases that from $25 million to $35 million. So that's the first change. That was in the base bill. In the amendments that were adopted in the Housing Committee, the second change has to do with certification requirements in certain cases for certain types of housing, making some modifications to that certification requirement, and then also changing the time period in which the loan or the credit is applicable. And this is another change that came by amendment in the Housing Committee. As of right now, that interest rate, that 4 percentage point difference and the value of the credit that goes to the lender is spread out over 20 years of the loan. In the change that was adopted by amendment, that would go to 30 years in some cases for some types of properties. So it would spread out that interest rate benefit and value of the credit to the lender in that case. All of these changes are applying to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2022. So that's what's in the bill that is coming to you from the Housing Committee. We also have a Dash A3 amendment that is at the request of Representative Fahey, who's the chair of the House Housing Committee. And that's relating to expanding the qualified purchase of bonds to include housing authorities. So one little additional a piece of this credit is that a lender, in addition to lending directly to someone who's built, say, building this affordable housing, this qualified affordable housing, they could also, the lender could also purchase bonds being issued by the Housing and Community Services Department that's doing this exact same thing. So build, say, let's continue with that example, building that affordable housing. The change in the A3 would also allow these lenders to qualify for the credit if they're purchasing bonds from a housing authority. So it expands a little bit where they can purchase those bonds. But again, that's in the dash A3 amendment. Again, that's a pretty brief overview of what this is and a lot to chew on, I guess, right away. But that's the setup for the bill, and happy to answer any questions specific to us in front of you here in House Bill 2584 and the dash A3 amendment.
Any questions for LRO? We're ready to start with our witness list. Do we have any additional names? I have four signed up. Are there any others that signed up before the deadline?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. The four names I have are Kristen Carley, Jacob Fox, Bill Van Vliet, and Peter Hanley. Let's go in that order, please. Kristen Carley.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Again, my name is Kristen Carley, and I'm here on behalf of St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County, a nonprofit community development corporation in Lane County that provides shelter and emergency services for the homeless, low barrier employment opportunities through our waste-based businesses, and over 1,600 affordable housing units. I'm here to express my support for House Bill 2584. St. Vincent de Paul has been developing affordable housing since 1988, and I have been doing so for 19 years. We use OHTC anytime we can in our affordable housing developments. We've used it on 26 of our projects, which include new construction, acquisition and rehabilitation of existing units, and acquisition and transformation of mobile home parks located in both urban and rural areas. We also think OHTC could be expanded to use to preserve older rent-restricted properties that currently cannot access funds to recapitalize and rehabilitate through Oregon Housing and Community Services. Increasing the cap would give us a better chance to work with Oregon Housing to preserve these very important properties. St. Vincent de Paul primarily serves households at or below 50% of area median income in our housing. We typically do not have project-based rental subsidies, so OHTC is essential for us to be able to drive down rents to that 50% AMI level. It has always been challenging to provide affordable housing for very low-income households. Now the costs of land as well as construction costs are higher than ever. We need every tool available in order to develop affordable housing as well as preserve existing affordable housing, and OHTC is one of those tools. Thank you again for your time and consideration, and I urge you to support House Bill 2584.
Thank you. The next witness is Jacob Fox.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, and Reschke committee members. My name is Jacob Fox. Very proud to represent Lane County as the Executive Director of Homes for Good, which is Lane County's housing authority. So I'm speaking on behalf of 22 housing authorities across the state of Oregon in support of House Bill 2584, and specifically the dash A3 amendment that Kyle referenced earlier. So as you know, the Housing Authority Network is the largest affordable housing network in the state of Oregon. As I mentioned, there's 22 housing authorities that represent 36 counties. Our goal is to provide safe, affordable housing for Oregonians with low incomes, and at the end of the day, we provide a home to them. Many people associate housing authorities with a housing choice voucher or Section 8 program, but we're also developers of affordable housing for Homes for Good. We specialize in affordable housing for people experiencing homelessness or people returning to Lane County after completing their prison sentence. So across the state, we own and manage 17,000 units of affordable housing. And during this housing crisis, we're being called to do more as it relates to deployment of rent assistance and development of new affordable housing. So one of the things that I want to do is just put a quick couple local examples. So the OHTC Homes for Good used to develop 70 units of affordable housing in the city of Springfield. We basically were able to borrow $1 million more because of the OHTC. That made the project financially viable, so it was super critical. We're also in the process of purchasing a mobile home park that burned in the Holiday Farm wildfire, and the OAHTC will be critical for us to rebuild and bring folks that have been displaced back to their homes in the wildfire impacted area. Specific to the A3 amendment, basically, OHCS has been the primary issuer of bonds for the 4% tax credit, but under ORS 456-175, housing authorities also can issue bonds. Because of the volume of affordable housing development, OHCS needs housing authorities to help with bond issuance, and that's what the A3 amendment does. Concludes my support of the bill, and Representative Nathanson, I just want to give you a shout out since you represent Lane County, and I appreciate you so much.
Thanks. It's good to see you today. The next witness is Bill Van Vliet.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Bill Van Vliet. I'm the executive director with NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. And we're a nonprofit lender who provides a variety of financing products for affordable housing developments statewide. I'm here to discuss House Bill 2584, which proposes to increase the cap of the OAHTC, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, from $25 to $35 million per year and make a few minor adjustments to the program. The OAHTC is a state income tax credit that benefits low-income renters in affordable housing developments. It's different from most tax credits in that it's not sold to investors. This credit allows banks to reduce interest rates on loans for affordable housing by 4% for 20 years and claim a state income tax credit each year equal to the lost interest income caused by the lower rate. In most cases, property owners must agree to pass through 100% of interest savings to low-income tenants in the form of rent reductions. I uploaded a handout into OLIS that you should have that also walks through this and provides an example on the back. I won't go into all of those details, but it walks you through the calculations of how this credit can work. There are two statutory exceptions to the interest savings pass-through requirement. One is preservation properties, where the majority of rent is paid for by HUD under contract and for the acquisition of manufactured home parks to preserve them as affordable housing, which is an increasingly urgent need in Oregon. Both of these cases, the lower interest rate allow for much higher private loans, as Jacob referenced, and much less public subsidy. The program leverages significant private capital. Every $1 million of tax credit results in $25 million of private loans. And in NOAA's experience, that $25 million in loans results in about $100 million of total development activity if affordable housing. So then that $1 million leads to a total of about $100 million of economic activity and affordable housing production in the state. There's some remaining capacity under the cap today, but at targeted deployment rates in the Oregon housing funding calendars, will hit the cap before the next opportunity to act. Moreover, this resource will be an important component in funding affordable housing in wildfire recovery areas, which will increase demand even further. These projects have long development timelines, and we need to know early in the process if this resource is going to be available. In addition to the cap increase, the engrossed bill proposes two statutory changes. I'll talk about those just briefly. The first is the current exception to the interest savings pass-through that Kyle mentioned is only for preservation projects that have federal rent assistance contracts. The bill proposes to expand the pass-through exemption to include all forms of project-based rent assistance to capture new rent subsidy programs that are being funded by state and local governments. The second would extend the length of the credit from 20 to 30 years for projects that receive rent assistance and other financial support from USDA rural development projects. Federal statutes governing those programs specifically don't align with the 20-year OHTC term, and this change will make those programs work with the OHTCs. And to the Dash 3 amendments, I think Jacob and Kyle both described those. It would be helpful to have the housing authority's capacity on bond issuances, and so this change would make that available to move projects along on a faster timeline to respond to the housing crisis and wildfire recovery. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this important program and the proposed changes to the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Our last witness is Peter Hanley.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Reschke and Pham. Peter Hanley with CASA of Oregon again. CASA of Oregon uses the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits for most of our farm worker projects that we develop. We talked about the tax credit a little bit earlier, and it only accounts for a portion of the total development costs. We do need to secure low-cost financing in order to keep those rents low. So we also use the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits on those projects. I think another key one, and Bill alluded to this, is the purchase of mobile home parks. For the last 12 to 13 years, CASA of Oregon's been working with residents in mobile home parks to convert them to resident ownership through a nonprofit cooperative model. We've converted 18 parks throughout the state, from Boardman to Gold Beach to Portland to Idlewild. And these communities, probably 75% of them are rural. And 15 of those 18 parks, we utilized this subsidy on it. And it's really important for keeping those rents low. We're currently working on two parks, one in Newport, which represents about 10% of the city stock. And then another park we're working in Springfield, which is the Patrician, and we're hoping to convert that here in the next year or so. We work with NOAA, who provides the loans on these and other financial institutions. I would urge passage of House Bill 2584. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the testimony. Committee, any questions for these four witnesses? Representative Reschke.
Thank you. I don't think they're for the four witnesses. They are for Mr. Easton. So if somebody has something for the four witnesses, I'll go ahead and wait.
Go ahead, Rep. Reschke.
All right. Well, thank you. Mr. Easton, can you tell me whether the bill applies to purchasing a currently constructed home or whether it's for new construction or is it for both?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, there is provisions that allow for rehabilitation to qualify as well, but it does have development, acquisition, and rehabilitation. And then there's the preserve projects, preserve housing, but that's more of in line with the federal program as well. But so there could be some of that rehabilitation cost to cover as well, yes.
Okay, so, and I guess my second question then is if you, is this primarily for property owners who want to then rent out the housing, or could somebody who qualifies for low-income housing actually get the loan directly from the bank and get the low rate themselves?
Representative Rushy, I would have to look on the numbers to give you a sense of what's kind of the use, where more of the use is to see. I believe it can be both, but I can reach out to the housing department to see if we can get numbers on breaking down some of the total credit amount into those categories.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good, we'll look forward to seeing some information in the future about that. Any committee members, any other questions or comments, clarifications you'd like from LRO? Let's see. I see a hand. Just a moment. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I'm not sure who I'd address this question to, but quite often mortgages that are initiated by a lender are immediately sold. Or sold soon thereafter, will these tax credits follow with whoever purchases a mortgage?
Yeah, Representative Smith, there are requirements on who can qualify, and usually based upon an area median income and a percentage of that. So in terms of that, I believe in most of the cases, the property itself, it would be who the next tenant would be, would have to meet those qualifications. But again, this is probably something I can follow up with if you're talking about an ownership, in this case, changing hands and making sure it stays in that low-income housing use, if I'm understanding you correctly.
Representative Smith, let's go into this a little bit more.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess just in my background, when mortgages are issued, they're sold quite often. The initiator of a mortgage very rarely keeps the mortgage. And so what I'm trying to determine is how do we make sure that the intent of our tax credit continues, knowing that different lenders may own that credit? And how do we make sure that there's compliance based upon who the tenants are? And again, I'm out over my skis on this. I'm just thinking of what traditional mortgages may be. And my question came as a result of Representative Breschke asking his question, how do we ensure that compliance? And so this is probably a conversation for another day, but nonetheless, I want to make sure that, you know, if someone's eligible for that tax credit, there's a compliance piece of it that we can ensure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. You know, we do have a few people available with us who are experts in this area of affordable housing and may have some experience that could answer the question right now. I would ask, does one of our witnesses, and I'll put one of you on this spot right now, either Mr. Van Vliet or Mr. Fox, would you happen to know the answer to that?
Thanks, Chair Nathanson. I can speak to some of these questions. With response to the question about selling loans, loans can be sold under this, but the key is that the credit has to be claimed under statute by an Oregon financial institution. So the loans can be sold from one financial institution to another, but the only entities that can claim the credit are defined in statute as an Oregon financial institution. And with respect to the affordability, Oregon Housing and Community Services Department places a regulatory agreement on these projects and has annual compliance measurement that happens to assure that ongoing affordability happens throughout the entire 20-year period. So I think both of those things are covered in these questions.
Thank you for that response. Representative Smith, does that cover it well enough for this afternoon?
Yeah, no, that was the answer I was looking for, and that was perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Easton, do you have anything to add before I close the public hearing?
No, Madam Chair.
Committee, any other comments before I close the public hearing? That was the end of our list of witnesses. I'm not seeing any hands. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2584. We have had several very interesting public hearings this afternoon. And I remember when we were hearing a bill in a previous session about hay balers, making a comment that I sure would like to go on a site visit. Well, we had a lot of things that have happened in the last year and a half, and we haven't been on a site visit. But I think it would be really interesting. I'm looking forward to a day when, for health reasons, it is safe and logistics are with us. I would look forward to a time when either the committee members together or individually in our own districts can go tour some of the places where we see the farm equipment being mentioned in our bills, or see some of the affordable housing projects in a before and after state. I do look forward to that time. Representative Smith.
I will wholeheartedly invite you all to do all the farming stuff. Seriously.
That's what I was just going to share, Madam Chair. Probably one of the hardest working, smartest, environmentally sensitive farmers you'll ever meet is on this committee. And you would gain so much experience and knowledge and perspective. Perspective's perhaps the right word, if you were able to spend a day with Representative Levy.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad Representative Levy had spoken first. Otherwise, it could have been awkward, Rep. Levy, that Rep. Smith just invited us all to go to your place.
Party at Bobby's house.
Yes, well, I'm serious. I would love to have you all because it's always great to tour things that you have never seen before. When I was on Fish and Wildlife Commission, I learned so much from doing all the tours I went on, and it was so enlightening that you learn so much. So, yeah, we would love to host you all, including LRO, if they would like to come and learn as well. We've got plenty of equipment you can drive, and you can see harvesting of different things, and you can meet all of our animals.
Thank you very much for
in the Doritos.
Pardon me, the what?
Chris is responsible for bringing the Doritos to the party.
My favorite.
Oh, golly. We have completed all the public hearings that we had on our agenda for the day. Mr. Alanak, do you have anything, any additional comments or observations or information for us before we close this meeting?
Not with respect to today's agenda. You have completed it. And just to let the committee members know, we're working to post the agendas for next week within the next either today or tomorrow morning. We're working on getting those agendas posted.
Thank you. Anything else from the committee? See you at the next meeting. We're adjourned.
Have a good weekend.